Music by John Williams, march from the film 1941, with the composer conducting the Boston Pops Orchestra here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Good afternoon. I'm Kevin Kelly. Our show is your connection to local performances, and I'm glad you were able to join us. Coming up, I'll be talking with singer-songwriter Dennison Whitmer, who is originally from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, lives currently in Philadelphia. He's going to be one of many performers inaugurating the Audio Feed Music Festival, which is coming to the Champaign County Fairgrounds this weekend in Urbana. He'll be there for a midnight show on Friday. And first on the show, we have two performers who are going to be participating in the second summer concert by the Urbana Pops Orchestra. They've got two programs this summer. We highlighted the first one. I was going to say earlier in the month, but this is a brand new month, isn't it? So early last month, and their next concert is coming up this Saturday night at the Urbana High School Auditorium, 7 o'clock, and it's a program called
Made in the USA.
Made in the USA. For, appropriately enough, for the July 4th weekend, that was the voice of Daniel Sutherland, who is the principal conductor of the Boston Pops. Excuse me, the Urbana Pops. Wouldn't that be nice?
I soon to be
that
the Boston
that's
Pops.
My dream job.
Yeah. Is that true?
I'll just tell him that you said I could do it.
Yeah, you'll find out how little clout I've got. Yeah, so Daniel Sutherland, principal conductor of the Urbana Pops Orchestra. And he has brought with him the featured soloist on that concert, who's pianist Ian Gindes, who's going to be playing, of all wonderful things, Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. So thank you, gentlemen, very much for coming in.
Thanks for having us. Mm-hmm.
And that music we just played will be among the things on the program.
Absolutely.
And so I've mentioned Rhapsody in Blue. What else have you got going on?
Actually, it's our salute to veterans. A lot of our we'll be actually doing a salute to our veterans. Really great arrangement. Rhapsody in Blue, of course. We just listened to 1941 by John Williams. We're going to do some Copland as well. This is Ceremonial Fanfare, which is one of his lesser-known fanfares. Copland is really known for Fanfare for the Common Man. It's kind of his, everyone knows that tune. But we're pulling out one of his other fanfares that is similar but is really kind of neat in its own right. And then we'll be doing The Promise of Living from the Tenderland set that he did, which was actually, as I understand it, a pretty big flop for him.
The Tenderland was was it a film? Or
it was a ballet, yeah. I believe, yeah. Or an opera.
I'm not sure either.
One of us should know this, I think. Between the two of us,
one
we
of
should
us
have
should
this knowledge.
Know this, yeah. Well, one of us probably does, but it's just, we're not sure which one of us it might be.
Well, that's why we don't know, is because it wasn't that successful, actually. So, except for the tune at the end, The Promise of Living, is really well known and often performed.
I think it's an opera. If this were a call-in show, somebody could call in and inform us definitively and probably embarrass us both by saying, well, it was none of the above. As a matter of fact, what do you think there is about Copland's music that causes it so often to be on Made in America programs?
He invented Americana. I mean, this, that American sound. Everyone who has been anyone in the right of an American composer has taken music from him. Even, we were listening to 1941 earlier, and it's pretty blatant borrowing of, Rodeo and his hoedown and everything like that. It's something about how, he really liked the sound of those really open intervals and how, he kind of attached that to our culture, and that's kind of where we've gone with it. So he kind of invented what we know as American music today.
So open intervals, you're talking about melodic intervals that have rather large leaps. And
sure, yeah, like you would play on a fiddle, for example. Some of those older Appalachian style, tunes and hymns and things like that.
And I think one of the theories has always been that the spaciousness of his music represented in the, sure, the openness of some of the melodies somehow represents the expanse of
the
US
frontier.
And the frontier and all that stuff. I mean, I really wonder how Well, he must have had some intention, because with a ballet like Appalachian Spring, which is actually the name of a poem, I don't think it had necessarily to do with the Appalachians, but the Ballet Rodeo, the ballet Billy the Kid, of course, the deliberately Americana. And those are still his most famous pieces, along with things like Lincoln Portrait and
which we did that a couple of years ago, and it's really interesting, actually, since we're talking about Copland, to see him go from tonal Copland, if you will, to him moving away from his younger writings and getting into something that we would consider a little bit more weird. Kind of moving away from traditional tonality. If you've ever heard any of his piano etudes, they're just crazy. It's nothing you would think was Copland. And it's just, kind of amazing.
Speaking of piano etudes and our pianist, Ian Gindes, recently, have you finished a degree at the University of Illinois?
I finished my doctorate degree in 2011.
You were on the show. I can't remember when it was.
It was
probably 2011.
Well, we actually did the 200th birthday anniversary of List, which actually went really well, and haven't been on the show ever since. So,
whenever
probably
that
need
was.
To change that.
Well, have you been around here since you finished the program? Have you been out and about doing performances? What's been happening?
I've been doing a lot of freelancing right now, just trying to get a lot of pieces ready to go. We're actually leaving right after this performance for the summer. We're going to be going over to Colorado Springs. They're having a festival over there with the Central City Opera, so I'll be down there, and then got a recital up close to Chicago when we get back in August. So we've been getting things. It's and now it's actually starting to roll in, so it's taking time for it to do that. So I've been primarily just practicing and trying to keep my chops up. So
so when you say getting things ready.
Yes.
For?
We have this concert, and then we have the recital in August that I'm going to have to probably start preparing the week I get back from Colorado Springs. So I'll have to probably do that the first week of August and practice probably 8 hours a day to get it and hopefully get it ready. And we're actually doing that on the 24th. And then from there, we're just going to start planning some more. We're working on a CD as well with a variety of American music, including Chris Becker's piece. And we've been working on that actually for the last year too. So
now you keep saying we.
Yes.
This is a team effort between?
We've been, well, for like the sound technician and tuner, and that's pretty much about it. Frank Horder actually has been helping me work on the CD, and we're not only are we recording, obviously we're going into it and we're doing, edits and, going through and making sure that the passages are clean. So we've got a lot of the pieces done, but then you have to go through and then do the editing process, which is quite cumbersome. So
Frank Horger, one of the audio engineers at the University of Illinois School of Music. You mentioned Chris Becker, a piece by Chris Becker.
Yes.
Of course, people listening weren't privy to our earlier conversation. Becker was a pianist who was also in the program here. He's gone from here now?
He actually graduated. He got his bachelor's here, and he graduated from Rice with his master's. And ever since then, he's been doing a lot of jazz playing and stuff. So he's kind of going into all kinds of genres, not even classical music, but rock and jazz and everything. So and composing a lot. So we've been staying in contact because I think that his music is fantastic and it has a lot of, I think it has a lot of recognition behind it, and I think it's going to go far. So we've been staying in touch because of that.
I'm pretty sure he's been on this program. It occurred to me I might be mixing him up with another pianist, but I think that he has in some capacity. And you brought along a piece of his to play for us today.
Yes, I actually brought his Passacaglia. I didn't bring the music, but let's hope I can toss it off.
You brought it in your head and
yes,
in your
I brought it in my head. My brain's here with me. So this comes from his set of pieces called The Four Curiosities. And it's about an unrequited love and fantastic piece. Just fell in love with it. And actually, when I was here in 2003, I remember him playing it all the way back then. And we would actually have practice sessions where we'd be up to like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning up in the practice room at Smith, you know, working on stuff. And he would just be tossing off jazz improv, you know, on Tchaikovsky. And, you know, he was very talented. Guy and I remember him playing this piece, and I heard it again. I was like, "This has a way to go. I think this is actually a fantastic piece. I think it has a lot of promise." So,
for those who don't know technical musical terms, and frankly, as a reminder for myself, because I've looked this up and I can never remember what exactly a passacaglia is.
And trust me, I looked it up right before I came on the show.
I know what it is.
All right,
here we go.
A whole suite in E flat actually is not a chaconne. The first movement is actually you have a theme that starts in the lower voices of the instrument or the ensemble, and a chaconne is the same formal structure, just not starting in the lower parts of the instrument.
It's usually like a bass ostinato that's repeated, and then you form off, and usually passacaglias are they're like variations and more repetitive structures and originated in the Baroque period and actually in Spain. So
a lot of composers still making use of them. Mm-hmm. And the first suite, you said it was first suite for a military band.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that was an editor thing, though, calling it a chaconne. Who knows? Maybe Holst didn't know what it was either.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. We won't get too far into into theoretical things, but that's one I always forget about. So, Passacaglia by Chris Becker, as played here by Ian Gindis, who will be playing on a concert by the Urbana Pops Orchestra this Saturday night at 7 at the Urbana High School Auditorium. And he's playing live on Live and Local. Thank you. Passacaglia by Chris Becker, played live in our studio by Ian Gindes. And you said that's part of a larger work, which is called?
The Four Curiosities.
Four Curiosities. And Ian will be playing Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue on a concert by the Urbana Pops Orchestra this Saturday night. Will you be doing any other shorter encore-type pieces, or that'll be enough for one night?
We might actually, I'll throw something in there and hopefully surprise some people.
It'll be a surprise. So.
It'll be a surprise. Well, not now. Just whatever.
Well, maybe
just
we won't do the it. Piece.
Of course, those things always depend on the uproarious applause that you will no doubt receive. Daniel Sutherland is principal conductor of the Urbana Pops, and I note here on your website that also on this concert, a preview of the Urbana Park District Summer Youth Theater musical.
It's become a long tradition of ours, I think, ever since we did our first season, and it's something we get really excited about. It's a really special program, enriches student acting and singing, and we're really excited about providing music for their show as well. So we'd like to give parents and some community members a taste of what the show is like, and just give them a chance to perform for a large group of people as well.
And what is the summer musical this year?
I cannot remember. I'm not conducting it this year. Oh no! Wait.
And I should
76
know.
Trombones. That's what it is. Music Man. Yeah.
Music Man.
They're doing
right.
Music Man.
Okay. And I should know too, because they're coming on. The look of panic on Daniel's face, precious right there. Well, things could be worse. You could be doing a radio show like Live and Local, and forget the name of the theater group that you're about to introduce.
Yeah, that's not.
Which did happen to me just the other week.
Recently, yeah. No one gets to see how freaked out we get, though.
Yeah, right. In any event, they're going to be coming on and doing a preview, I think, later this month.
Oh, great.
I forget when the show is, but I live from day to day just about on this on this radio program. We have another brief, actually a recording that Ian made of some music by, since we're talking about Gershwin, Rhapsody in Blue, this is Earl Wilde's transcription of a pretty famous tune of his.
Mm-hmm.
Earl Wilde actually having done what I think is one of the most wonderful recordings of Rhapsody in Blue.
Oh, yeah. I think that his is the... Definitely listen to his for my interpretation, and it's always on the top of the list.
It's fast.
Yeah, it is. It's a little bit... There are points where it's a little bit too fast at the end. I would kind of pull back a little bit and give the orchestra and pianist time to kind of throw the fireworks out there, but it is pretty incredible.
Let's give a brief listen. Ian Gindes here in Embraceable You. Thank you. George Gershwin's Embraceable You, in an arrangement by Earl Wilde, quite virtuosic to say the least, and played by Ian Gindes, who is actually sitting with us here in the studio. He didn't do that one live. That one was recorded. And any edits, or did you do it straight? Or don't you want to say?
That, I'm trying to think. That actually has, I'll be honest, it has three edits on it. I think we
That's
put
not bad.
No, we actually, I was surprised, myself. So.
A lot of notes.
Yeah.
As there was a quote of that in Amadeus, I think. Yeah. The prince or whatever he was called was a misguided person in reference to Mozart. Not relevant to the concert.
It's the theme of today.
It's, yeah. It's a good scene.
Good, great scene. A lot of good scenes in that movie. The Urbana Pops Orchestra will feature Ian Gindes in Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue Saturday night at 7 o'clock. It's a free concert, thanks to a City of Urbana Arts grant. Daniel Sutherland will conduct some of the program.
Most of it.
Most of the program. Of and Stephen Larson, the rest of it?
Yeah, he'll do the Park District preview. Park District, and he's going to do a North by Northwest by Bernard Herrmann as well.
So. Oh, fun. Yeah. And that'll be 7 o'clock. In the auditorium at Urbana High School on Race Street. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for coming in on Live and Local.
Thank you so much.
And stay tuned. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, a conversation with singer-songwriter Dennison Whitmer, who will be performing at the first Audio Feed Music Festival, which is happening in Urbana this weekend. This is Live and Local. A bit of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, just the very opening, Leonard Bernstein leading the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra. If you made a financial gift to Illinois Public Media over the last 12 months, you helped us make a real difference in the community. You've made it possible for listeners throughout Central Illinois not only to enjoy countless hours of great live local music coverage, but also all the other incredible services this station provides as well. I'm pleased to share with you that on June 30th, Illinois Public Media exceeded its fundraising goal for fiscal year 2013. So on behalf of all the community members whose lives are enriched by this music, this station, and I'd like to say this program, we thank you for your support. The song is called Born Without the Words. It comes off of the latest album by Dennison Whitmer, which is a self-titled record. Came out just in April of this year, I think. And he's going to be among the headliners at the Audio Feed Music Festival, which is happening at the Champaign County Fairgrounds in Urbana this weekend. And he's going to be performing for a very late night show at midnight on Friday. On the main stage, I think they're calling it the Sean Michel's Arkansas stage, actually, if I'm even saying his name right. And very pleased to welcome Dennison Whitmer to the program today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, from my home state of Pennsylvania.
That's right. It's a great place to be. We're the Keystone State, so we're holding it all together. So.
Yeah, that's whatever that means.
Exactly.
I hear Pennsylvania is doing about as badly as Illinois financially, at least in the government.
Yeah, we're not in such great shape. We could go on for hours about that. You know, I have a young son, and I'm watching the school systems here in Philadelphia crumble, and I'm thinking, how am I going to pull this off, you know? So it's always something to think about.
Well, speaking of pulling things off, I picked that opening song, at least from the title, mm-hmm. Just by way of getting rolling with some of the early part of your career, because, of course, one isn't born writing songs, but one sometimes stumbles onto this sort of thing, I guess. And
sure.
I wonder how you got your start. I mean, just reading through your bio that's that you sent me, it's there's a certain amount of accident that seems to have gone on throughout your career.
Yeah, sure. I always tell people that being a musician for vocation is something that kind of chose me rather than me choosing it. I mean, of course, you know, I pursued it, and so there's an element of me making a decision to pursue it. But when I was about 16 years old, my older brother suggested I get a guitar for my birthday. I'm one of four boys in my family. The older brother, his name is Douglas. He's a very creative guy, and all of us looked up to him. And so I thought, well, I'll get a guitar. And I was writing poetry, but I was never writing music. And I'm a self-taught guitarist. I never really took very many lessons. And so from there, I kind of just started putting poems over music that I was making up. And next thing I knew it, I had songs. And I met a gentleman in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, a guy named Don Paris, who was in a band called the Innocence Mission. At that time, they were like a major label band, and he basically just said that he wanted to try out some of his new recording equipment. He asked me if I could be the guinea pig for his songs, and we made a record together. I'm dating myself a little bit here, but to give you a quick breakdown, basically what ended up happening was this: I wanted to make some CDs, and at that time the minimum run you could manufacture was 1,000 copies. So I made 1,000 CDs, knowing that I had maybe 50 friends and 50 family members that I wanted to give the CDs to, and not knowing what I would do with the rest of them. That's exactly what happened. I mean, I ended up with like 900 CDs in my parents' basement and no real plan for how to get rid of them. And when my parents asked me what I wanted to do with them, I decided to just try to make a go at booking my own little tour and selling them from there. And I got lucky, I have to say. I toured for a few weeks, kind of lost all my money, came home, made a little bit more money, went back out, did the same thing, but I managed to get rid of all the CDs. And that's when a record label found me and offered me to remanufacture. So I said, sure. And then they said, let's do it again. And then they said, let's do it again. And so here I am today, several record labels later, but still making records.
And this is what, your 10th album, something like that?
Yeah, it is. It's my 10th. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about the notion of poetry in songwriting, because I've occasionally asked songwriters before whether they feel that they're writing poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And you might be the first one who told me that that's how you in fact got started. And I wondered if you feel as you're writing songs now, if that's still what you're doing.
Sometimes I'd say they're poetic at moments, at their best, I guess. But I mean, I tend to write kind of a journal type of approach, you know, and my poems are always the same way, you know. They're just little epiphanies that I might have, just, you know, something that I've been thinking about a lot that I want to try to work out and make sense. And that's really what my lyrics are about, too. And, you know, I guess I feel like I get lucky when something that sounds poetic comes out of me, but that's not necessarily always my agenda. Sometimes I just want to say things very plainly and very simply, just because I relate to very simple things, and I also relate to very personal things. So for me, the more personal it is and the more simple it is, the more it hopefully translates to the listener.
You said what your lyrics are about generally. Do you feel that there is a running theme throughout your lyrics, throughout your songs?
Yeah, I guess there is. You know, it's funny. As an artist, you feel like you're on a career, the arc of your career is this journey, right? You start in one place and you end up somewhere else. And I always tell people it's never really been that way for me. It's kind of a little bit like a tree where you kind of circle and you move out from the center, but you're always kind of circling back over the same themes. And I think for me, those themes would definitely be, love and loss and family and, just some of my upbringing with like a tilt towards simplicity and peacemaking and joy. Yeah, so I think I probably write about the same things over and over again.
Do you feel that you have had to make some effort at peacemaking and simplicity? Personally,
only in my own heart. You know, only things that I different life things that have happened to me where I've had to kind of decide. You know, do I want to get bitter or do I want to just find a peaceful place? You know, and I think. I have to say, I'm very lucky with my upbringing. I was raised Mennonite in Lancaster, and the Mennonite Anabaptists, you know, they're very peaceful people and very simple and very earnest and kind and forgiving. And I think that instilled a lot in me that's still with me today. You know, I don't attend a Mennonite church anymore, but I definitely will always relate as a Mennonite in that way.
That's a religion, I guess, that probably most people have stereotypes about more than actually knowing much about.
Yeah. Do I have electricity? Am I Amish? You know, that kind of thing. And although the Mennonite church and the Amish church were indeed the same church at one point, that was in Europe, and that was, you know, in the late 1700s.
Well, out here,
before actually.
Yeah. Well, out here in Central Illinois, we do have a Mennonite community. An Amish community actually, and probably both.
Yeah. Sure.
Right nearby here, and certainly within our listening area. And
great.
So I'm not going to presume to say much about it, because we've got knowledgeable listeners. So you can speak to them if you want.
Same last name as me. I'm sure they do.
Whitmer? I don't know. I'd have to look it up.
Yeah.
Yoder is certainly one.
Yeah, Yoder and Stolzfus and Weaver and Wanger. You know, it's funny. I was just on tour in Europe, and I was traveling through all these areas. In Holland, and then also across Germany down into Switzerland, and I kind of traced a little bit of my heritage at the time, you know, because the Mennonite Church started in the Friesland area of Netherlands, and kind of worked its way down through Germany and into Switzerland, which is where my family came from.
Well, let's hear another song off of your latest album. This is one that is not by you. But it connects to you pretty, well, I suppose indirectly. It's called Asa, which is the name, which is a name. Why don't you tell us about this one?
Okay, well, my wife and I have a 17-month-old son, and his name is Asa. It's spelled A-S-A. It's an Old Testament name. He was a king in the Old Testament, and when we announced our son's name, a friend of mine from Toronto sent me an email, and she said, hey, you know, I work with this artist named Bry Webb, and he also has a son named Asa, and he wrote this song for his son. And she emailed it to me, and when I heard it, I knew I had to cover it right away. Even though I'm not much of a covers artist, sometimes you hear something that just, you feel like you can sing with the same type of honesty as something that you wrote. And what I especially like about this song is that he managed to weave all the different name meanings of Asa into the lyrics. So Asa means the first light of morning in Japanese, and in some West African languages it means a little hawk. And in Hebrew it means healer. And so if you perk your ears up to the lyrics, you'll hear some of those meanings kind of work their way through the words.
Do you sing the song pretty straight as a cover, or do you do anything of your own to it?
It's pretty true to the original as far as just the melody is concerned, although we kind of added a little bit more of a gospel feel to it. The whole album has a very kind of meditative and I call it like patient, reverent kind of approach. So the one thing that I really wanted to get across with this album is patience and stillness. And so I made a record that a lot of people, I think if they listen to it once, they might go, oh, okay. But hopefully it'll grow on people. And that's been what most people have been telling me. They're like, about the fourth listen is when the album really starts to set in. And I like that. You know, I'm definitely kind of the school of trying to make something that stands the test of time, and also is kind of a little bit of a pushback against kind of the information inundation type of culture that we live in, where everything is so temporary and everything kind of comes at us so quickly. I made this album to still myself as much as I made it to hopefully still other people.
Let's give a listen. It's called Asa. And what's the name of the songwriter?
His name is Bri Webb.
Bri as in boy, R-Y?
I think it's short for Brian.
Brian.
B-R-Y.
Yeah. Webb, and a song here by Dennison Whitmer off of his latest album. He's going to be in Urbana as part of one of many performers at the Audio Feed Music Festival. He'll be singing at midnight on Friday, and you're hearing him on Live and Local on FM 90.9.
Let the sun rise in the morning. Let the shadows grow until the evening comes. I will carry you home.
Dennison Whitmer singing a song called Asa, which also happens to be the name of his son. Here on Live and Local on FM 90.9, he'll be in Urbana Friday night late as part of the Audio Feed Music Festival. I'll be talking with other folks performing during that festival, including on tomorrow's show, and I think Wednesday and Friday we'll be having features on other artists going to be participating in that. Dennison, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the business of co-owning a recording studio. You said earlier that somebody picked you up kind of by accident, a label picked you up, and then you've had albums on different studios since, the current one on Asthmatic Kitty, which is a label the name of which I love. But you have your own still, or was that a short-lived thing?
No, I'm still very much involved. It kind of was another accidental type of career move where I was working with a producer here in Philadelphia who wanted to move to New York and kind of pursue his music production a lot more full time. And I had just come into a little bit of money just from having some of my songs used on some TV shows. And so I kind of thought, well, I can make an investment right now in owning a studio space, in the hopes that I don't have to pay for recording studios anymore. And so he and I kind of designed the place together, and then we built it as well. I bought a house in Philadelphia, I guess it's been about 6 years ago, and I loved rehabbing it. And so I learned a lot about carpentry at that time, and I felt pretty capable in being able to actually physically build the space. So it was fun for me just to kind of design and build a space that I was going to be making my records in, and that's what I've been able to do, and we're in a fortunate enough position now where we've been able to open it to the public and have other people come in and record. It's funny because it's based in New York City. It's in Brooklyn, even though I'm in Philadelphia. But that's just how it worked out because I don't record other people quite as much as he does, and I use it kind of as a space to kind of get away from home for a couple of days and kind of work in a really focused environment.
And so when you do record now, do you do the recording there and then somebody else edits and then a label picks it up? Or what is that process like?
Well, the process is, I mean, we do the whole recording there and we do all the mixing there as well. And then the label's involvement is really in manufacturing the vinyl and the compact discs and distributing the digital media and advertising. Yeah, we can do everything from start to finish there, except for doing the promotion and releasing the album.
Yeah, the whole marketing business, which is the hard work, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's funny, you know, like when people hear a record, I mean, it's funny to explain to your friends that, you know, what they're hearing costs probably less than what it costs to actually promote what they're hearing. So it's always funny when I do my accounting with the record label to see what we spend on just promotion compared to what we spend recording the music.
Yeah, and then of course you hope that the purchase price and ends up covering that. You mentioned LPs, so you're among the current wave of artists that's bringing back the LP.
Yeah, I think the consumers are bringing it back more than the artists are. I mean, it's been pretty interesting. I mean, a lot of people are into the tangible. You know, they want that experience. And CDs just, you know, they seem a lot more antiquated than LPs, only in that the LPs kind of create an experience when you step over to your record player and you pick it up and flip it over. You know, you're participating in a way that maybe you're not when you put on a CD. And so I think it's really nice. I think it's heartwarming to think that people still buy music in that way, and that they want something that's tangible.
It's a little more purely for the music, maybe, because it takes some effort to put it on.
Yeah, sure, exactly. Yeah, when there's effort involved in something, you know, you're invested. And I think a lot of music has kind of become background music these days, and that's okay. I mean, I understand, you know, there's a time and a place for that, but, you know, there are those collectors and listeners out there that really want something that they can call theirs, you know, and have a personal kind of feeling with, so... it's not a very eloquent way of saying it, is it? But, you know, I appreciate that people are buying vinyl, and I have to say that I probably sell just as many vinyl as I do CDs anymore.
No kidding. Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah. Well, and actually, you know, it may or may not have been eloquent, but it certainly leads to the last song I wanted to play, because you're talking about the personal approach, you're talking about a certain amount of effort going into things, and certainly in order to... make the career you have, been a lot of effort, but also this last song we're going to do, I understand, is one of the most directly personal on the record. It's your song called Constant Muse.
Yeah.
Want to talk about that briefly before we go out?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I've been very fortunate that I've been able to make music for a living. You know, it's something that I don't take for granted. I'm flattered that people still buy my records and that I get to tour in support of them. But it is a strange transition that the business is going through, where you know, with digital distribution and digital media, you know, a lot less people are actually paying for music in a lot of ways. And even though we're selling vinyl, the markup is just so much lower that you kind of have to be creative and find different ways to make music for money. And I've always seen the business side of it as kind of just a happy byproduct of the art. And I want to keep focusing on my art. And when that stops paying me, I'll do something else. And I guess I was feeling a little bit like, before I made this record, some of that was in question. And I was like, well, which direction am I going to go? You know, I've spent my early 20s until my mid 30s, you know, pursuing this as a vocation. And it's been great, but I just don't know what it means for me and my family long-term as far as touring and things like that. So I just thought about that a little bit, and this kind of song, this is the song that came out of that.
So. Well, it's a beautiful song. Dennis.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome, and thanks for joining us on the show, too.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
It's Dennison Whitmer's Constant Muse from his latest CD, which happens to be called Dennison Whitmer, from just this past April. And he's going to be at the AudioFeed Music Festival, taking place at the Champaign County Fairgrounds in Urbana. His show will be on the first night into the first morning, I guess, at midnight on Friday. And you can get a complete schedule by going to audiofeedfestival.com.
Is my mind at ease, or am I jaded?
Dennison Whitmer, his song called Constant Muse. Here on Live and Local on FM 90.9, where support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Service of Illinois. Blood donations decrease during the summer months, but patient needs remain the same year-round. There are no substitutes for donated blood, and donation only takes 45 minutes. Blood donation, it's about life. More information is at 367-2202. You're listening to 90.9 WYLFM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music and More for Central Illinois. It's 5 o'clock.